Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's that nail-biting time of the year when fourth-year medical students find out which residency program they are being matched with.
Well, that's an exciting time for the U.S. medical school grads. And in total, there's a record number of physicians applying for residencies. And the particularly good news, Mark, more applications for primary care residencies this year than we've seen. An increase by 400 to roughly 6,400 who are planning to have primary care careers.
Though estimates vary, a projected shortfall of primary care physicians is looming large. And there are provisions in the Affordable Care Act aimed at addressing that shortfall. I should note one of them, which is our own nurse practitioner residency program, which you started, and we have 8 slots this year, and we're looking forward to a great crop of residents.
That's right, and it's going to be interesting to follow the trends around primary care and who chooses to be a primary care provider and how we adapt our training systems to meet their needs. But this is a good start, seeing an uptick in the number of medical students choosing primary care residency.
There's another trend that I think we're going to hear a lot more about, and that's the call for transparency in healthcare pricing. The lack of pricing transparency has been a big driver in increased healthcare costs.
Recent report yielded some pretty dismal findings. 29 states around the country get an F for healthcare pricing policies that are supposed to assist patients and families when making healthcare decisions.
That's because in those states, there are laws allowing insurance companies to keep their pricing hidden from patients until the patient gets the bill. Can you imagine buying a car or going to a restaurant with that sort of policy?
Well, that would be sticker shock to a significant degree. And it's a problem that was very clearly elucidated in a recent article in Time magazine by Stephen Brill, who found wildly varied price quotes for the same exact procedure across multiple hospitals in just one community. So I think Brill has really shown the spotlight on the scope of the problem.
And the report card that was put out by the nonprofit Catalyst for Payment Reform only showed 2 states that scored an A. Massachusetts and New Hampshire, suffice to say, when it comes to price transparency in healthcare, we have a long way to go in this nation.
And our guest today is seeking to improve transparency of another kind, and that's making more public health and medical data available through health information technology. Brian Civic is the Chief Technology Officer for Health and Human Services, and he talks about the trend at HHS to open source as much health data as possible.
Lori Robertson of FactCheck.org looks at claims that the healthcare law is a tax burden on the middle class.
And no matter what the topic, you can see all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at CHC Radio or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
Now we'll get to Brian Civic in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The federal government will likely be playing the role of enforcer in several states. Vocal, even vociferous opponents of the healthcare law are refusing to follow directives in the law that ensure changes are made to the state insurance markets to adhere to new ACA guidelines. Texas, Oklahoma, Wyoming, and Missouri have refused to enact legislation that would set new parameters on the insurance industry to align with insuring all Americans by 2014. This leaves federal health officials no choice but to take measures to pick up the slack in those states. Meanwhile, 71 million Americans received some kind of free preventive screening thanks to the Affordable Care Act. The report by the Kaiser Family Foundation combined with U.S. Census data yielded the figure. Preventive screening and early detection are the best known deterrents against expensive and catastrophic illness. The coming tsunami of Alzheimer's, it's the theme of this year's TEDMED conference in April. It would appear the first waves have hit the shore. Study shows the number of deaths from Alzheimer's increased 68% from 2000 to 2010. It's now the 6th leading cause of death for which there are few treatment options and no known cure. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Brian Civic, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Civic recently served as the Chief Innovation Officer for the state of Maryland and was Chief Technology Officer for the District of Columbia. He got his start in the private sector as an IT entrepreneur and is co-founder of several successful startups, including Electric Knowledge, which created one of the world's first natural language speaking search engines. Mr. Civic has also been a longtime promoter of code sharing and open source methods of expanding IT innovation. Brian, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
You know, your job at Health and Human Services is to harness the power of data, technology, and innovation to improve health and well-being of our nation. And you took over from Todd Park, who we like to say Todd's middle name is Liberate Data, who initiated that role. And you're monitoring everything from healthcare options for millions of Americans, from keeping food safe to infectious disease outbreaks at bay. The health data management volume seems to be pretty staggering. So tell us a little bit about the programs like healthdata.gov, as well as the Health Data Warehouse, and how they're helping HHS shift to a more open and transparent government.
Sure. One of the most amazing assets that we have here at the Department of Health and Human Services is really the vast quantity of data that our agencies create and maintain. And, you know, it's been realized for a while now that this asset really needs to be leveraged to a greater extent. And so, as you know, you mentioned a few years ago, my predecessor, Todd Park, came in and really started focusing on getting this information out to the public, to the entities that could actually take advantage of this, entrepreneurs, insurance companies, providers, you know, anyone in the system, actually consumers. I mean, anybody who touches the healthcare system at all can use this information. We, over the last few years, have undertaken a fairly significant program to liberate this data, which really means changing the default setting inside HHS from one of sort of protection of this asset to one of release of this asset. And we've done a great job, I think, to this point of really changing that default, getting people to realize that data is valuable, that it should be open by default with obvious protections in place for, you know, making sure that we don't release personally identifiable information. The, I would say, most recent manifestation of this is the healthdata.gov website, which is sort of the second version of our data warehouse. And we're building this actually all on open source technology so that anybody can use this for themselves, contribute code, you know, improve the system itself. But internally, the whole idea is that we're making a system that should be easy for people to interact with in order to upload their data sets so that we can make it available to just about anybody out there.
Brian, you've said that in the past you had a ton of fun during your early days as an IT entrepreneur. But much of what spawned that early innovation was collaboration with peers on how to build these better platforms for data sharing. Now you've shifted your skills to the public sector and you have an opportunity to help government help innovators, which you've euphemistically called an interesting challenge. So tell us about these unique and interesting challenges that you face in bringing public entities and bringing government into this 21st century exciting world of data sharing and IT innovation.
So the first thing I'll say is you should always beware when a geek calls a problem interesting, because that's usually code for very, very difficult. But, you know, I started my career at a college basically writing code for a startup that I co-founded. And I'm a tech entrepreneur at heart, and I'll kind of always self-identify as one. But one of the things that, you know, I think I realized in this role or in that world, I should say, is that success is really all about being able to accept risk and learn from mistakes. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges in the public sector is just the willingness to take on risk. If you think about the idea of innovation, either in technology or in any sense, it requires experimentation. And so I think if we want to innovate in the public sector, we need to learn how to take some chances. You know, if I look across the now three different jobs that I've had in government at all different levels of government, it really, in order to innovate, we need to take some of these chances. And my job is really to help people assume this risk. The other thing I would say is that, you know, governments in general are sort of large, somewhat ossified entities that have very established silos and walls between various programs and entities. And there's a huge amount of value that's trapped up in those silos.
You've also been engaged, maybe in Maryland, when you launched the program called Civic Commons, which inspired by an attempt to get more interconnectivity between the states and the governments. It seems to me it's sort of a virtual back end for states, if you will. Can you tell us more about how Civic Commons initiative works and sort of the policy behind it and what's the funding mechanism moving forward?
Yeah, so, you know, the first thing I'll say is that was an idea we hatched back in D.C. With Code for America, not just within organizations, but cross jurisdictions. People are working on pretty much the same thing over and over and over again. So if you look at, you know, cities. Almost every city has to have a certain set of infrastructure that they need to create in order to operate that city effectively, and we end up not doing a good job of sharing some of those things. And you see this repeated over and over again as you go up the jurisdictional ladder. And so really what Civic Commons was, it's an attempt to provide a relatively frictionless platform for sharing not just code or applications, but also ideas or policies or funding methodologies or what have you, in order to reduce the initial cost of development, reduce the cost of maintenance going forward, spread good ideas. That was the intention behind it.
Brian, it seems, as we look back, the Obama administration made a pledge to continue to work on making government more open and more transparent. And one of the initiatives in keeping with this goal is a partnership between Health and Human Services and the Institute of Medicine to launch the Community Health Data Initiative, making the data more available to innovators and entrepreneurs. HHS recently participated in the Health Data Palooza Forum in Washington, D.C. Tell us about some promising innovations that are growing out of those efforts that were unveiled there.
Sure. So the Data Palooza, as we affectionately call it here, is a. It was actually the third iteration of this event, which started roughly 2.5 or 3 years ago. And I think it's pretty amazing when you look at the path that it's taken. It started, like I said, a couple of years ago with 40 people sitting in a room in a pile of data. And a challenge to come back 90 days later with some interesting applications. It turned out that, you know, 90 days later, over 2 dozen people showed up, or 2 dozen different applications were presented that, you know, showed us the potential for utilizing this data that we have. And it's grown ever since. The second iteration was somewhere around 600 people. The Data Palooza 3 had 1,600 people. There were over 200 apps that applied to present. I mean, it's really been quite phenomenal. Huh. You know, a couple of good examples that have come out of this. There's a company called iTriage that we talk about a lot. This is a entity that was started by an ER doc, basically trying to use mobile applications to diagnose individuals mm-hmm. based on certain symptoms that they were presenting. And then they leverage some of our data in order to help drive people to the right provider at the right time based on the diagnosis of those symptoms. They were actually bought by Aetna recently. They've got 80 people. They're growing. They're doing really well. And so that's a great example. Another good example is a company called Humetrics, which for those folks out there who've heard of this thing called Blue Button, basically there's this technology that we've been working on in conjunction with the Veterans Administration for the last couple of years, which allows people to click a little blue button on a website and get their personal health record. This version of it doesn't have any specific structure associated with it. And so what Humetrics did was created an application called iBlueButton, which essentially takes this download of personal health data and translates it into a visual representation that's useful for the patient and for the doctor and for whoever else needs to see it. So that's another great example of an entity that has come out on this.
We're speaking today with Brian Civic, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Civic recently served as the Chief Innovation Officer for the State of Maryland and was Chief Technology Officer for the District of Columbia. Let's talk a little bit about innovation, and it seems to be central to the new paradigm at HHS. And in fact, the department just announced its fifth round of winners in the HHS Innovates program, which is intended to facilitate the exchange of innovative ideas that will enhance health and well-being for Americans. And so for the first time, you had a People's Choice winner and allowed the public to vote on this. So can you share with us some of the more exciting innovations that came out of this program, and also how much participation did you get from the public on this?
Sure. So, you know, as you said, this round we had the first iteration of the People's Choice Awards, which was pretty exciting. We let the world basically vote on the finalists.
By Twitter, or how did they vote?
No, they voted on the internet.
On the internet.
Yeah, we had a web page up on our site. But Twitter's a good idea. Maybe we'll do that next time. We actually had remarkable participation. It was kind of cool. Tens of thousands of votes were cast. And one of the winners, actually, of this round, I think the story is pretty awesome. The National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases basically came out with this application they call Free Stuff. And it's a really simple idea, I think, but it's a very powerful idea. Basically, in the past, you'd have a bunch of stuff within the organization that people had bought over time they didn't need anymore. And, you know, typically these things, whether it's like a piece of lab equipment or a piece of furniture, would go back into some warehouse in, you know, the middle of Maryland to sit there for a while until some, you know, government process actually took care of it. Nobody really knows how that works or what happened into it. These guys realized that, you know, just because I didn't need this centrifuge anymore, somebody else might be able to use it. And so they put together essentially, think of it as Craigslist for, mm-hmm. you know, government equipment, that, you know, a website that internal employees can actually look at.
Is there actually a big room like Raiders on the Lost Ark at the end where they find the Holy Grail? Is that?
in my imagination, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And I hope that somewhere on one of those dusty shelves is an ark covered with a cloth. You know? But this story to me is pretty cool because basically the idea for this came up literally when this employee of this agency was out for a run one day. She goes back to the office, recruits a couple of people, and in their spare time, they put it together. And a little while later, you know, now it's being nominated for the HHS Innovates program, and it wins, and it's great. So that's a great example. Mm-hmm. Another great example, I think, is the Center for Disease Control's zombie apocalypse story. I don't know if you guys have heard of that, but basically, they used this marketing campaign of a zombie apocalypse for disaster readiness. And it won because I think it was very unique and different for governments to start marketing from this perspective. But the coolest thing happened to me the other day. I was on an airplane back from San Francisco to D.C., sitting there the whole flight, working, putting my stuff away at the end. And the guy sitting next to me, he had seen me kind of working this whole time and asked me what I did. I told him my job. And he looked at me and says, I have one question. I said, what's that? He said, what are you guys doing about the zombie apocalypse?
Oh, really? That's great.
It blew my mind, right? Yeah. Because there's a random guy kind of on this airplane who had heard about this stuff and knew some of what we had been doing, which probably wouldn't have gotten out there had we not done a program like HHS Innovate. So I think these things really have some very mm-hmm. significant effect.
Well, Brian, I have to tell you, the zombie apocalypse was a little bit like the Martian invasion in some communities
right.
where people did take it kind of seriously. But, you know, one of the words that keeps coming up over and over in various manifestations is connect. And this is sort of central to the work that you're doing, it seems, connecting such disparate data that is stored and managed by HHS. And when you go to your healthdata.gov website, as our listeners are probably doing, there's a nice visual there that links all these programs into a constellation: Medicare, Medicaid, the Center for Disease Control, and anybody can access the site and find all kinds of significant health data on numerous topics. So the question to me is, who's using the site and who's mining the data? Is it public health officials, people working on community transformation, clinicians? Are you able to glean some intelligence on who's using the data in the public?
We have a ton of anecdotal evidence that people across the spectrum are actually using healthdata.gov and accessing the data sets, doing interesting things with the information. But we are constantly working on engagement and trying to get other folks and different communities involved. In fact, one of the big efforts that we are undertaking right now is really one of kind of connecting different groups of people that don't typically think about health data and kind of bringing them into the fold. So, you know, I think in the past, you've really needed to be a subject matter expert to understand a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. We're going to try to make some of these pieces of information more accessible. We're going to try to reach out to developer communities, to entrepreneurs, to venture capitalists, to, you know, any doctor out there. I mean, all of these different communities that we want to get involved, we're going to try to, you know, broaden the tent a little bit and get more and more folks involved. The neat thing is that since we launched healthdata.gov, I mean, we've had hundreds of thousands of visits on the site. We're constantly improving the functionality. I would stress one thing is that this is sort of, I would slap a beta label on this in a lot of ways because mm-hmm. we are constantly looking at different things that we can do to make it more usable and more functional. And we're going to be doing some stuff around that in the near future. So keep your eyes on it.
Is that part of the government's new digital strategy? I know it's focusing on three things: making content more accurate, available, and secure. And you've been promoting application programming interfaces, or APIs, which are tools for building software. Applications is an important part of that process. So tell us about these APIs and why they're so important in securing meaningful use of government health data.
Sure. So basically what an API does is it allows a developer to access content and data in a machine-readable, but more importantly, a predictable way. So they can make a functional call to a service and actually get a piece of data back that they expect in a certain format, and then they can do something with it because it's in a certain format. You know, in the past, developers have had to resort to techniques called, for example, like screen scraping, where they literally try to, using a program, read what's on a screen. And that's obviously a very brittle way to do something, because if the format of the display changes, then we obviously have a challenge with, you know, having to update the program. So, you know, there's some great examples out there. I think one really quick one is an app called Healthline that was built basically using APIs that the National Library of Medicine puts out. And that's all about basically providing information to consumers, beneficiaries, about diseases and conditions and all kinds of stuff like that. And that's just one example. I mean, there are plenty of other ones. And one of the components of the digital strategy is actually to API enable as much content and data as we possibly can to make this even easier for everybody.
We've been speaking today with Brian Civic, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services. You can find out more about these innovation initiatives by going to healthdata.gov. Brian, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, we recently heard competing claims about the amount of taxes in the Affordable Care Act. Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, said that there were, quote, $1 trillion in middle-income tax increases. And Democratic Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz said that there are not $1 trillion in taxes. So what's the truth? Well, the law will cost $1 trillion over 10 years. That includes taxes, fees, penalties for not having insurance, and associated revenue effects, which occur when employees receive higher wages, which are taxed, if they drop or lose their health insurance, which is not. But Johnson exaggerates when he says all of these taxes and fees would be middle-income tax increases, and he ignores the fact that the law will help millions of middle-income folks buy insurance. The taxes and fees in the law fall heavily on upper-income taxpayers and businesses. More money comes from fees on businesses in the healthcare field and penalties on businesses that do not offer insurance to their employees. Some will be subject to a penalty for not having health insurance, but less than half of the penalty revenue will come from those earning less than $120,000 a year. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. The nation is battling an obesity epidemic, and it's hitting our children especially hard. Turns out the very thing perceived to be one of the causes, the sedentary pastime of sitting in front of a screen playing video games, could provide a great solution. The folks at Hope Labs have cooked up another video game aimed at improving kids' health. Now comes Zamzi, a competitive video game designed to get kids moving. Hope Labs VP and Communications Director Richard Tate says it's a pretty simple concept. Equip kids with a movement monitor, which they plug into their computer at the end of the day, and compete against other kids on how much they move that day. And there are rewards for each kid based on their level of activity.
The Zamzi website uses sound principles of motivational science to get kids moving more, where they experience success and feel competence and mastery. And that kind of positive experience keeps kids moving over time.
And as with their game Remission, when kids compete with a larger population, they're more inclined to want to succeed.
And there is a sense of discovery and excitement to see how many points you've earned, you see how many points you're racking up over time. And then with Zamzi, those points actually power your online experience. It allows you to compare and compete. meet with others on the site.
Hope Labs has been testing Zamzee, and the results are significant. Kids playing the Zamzee video game moved an average 60% more per day than kids in the control group that didn't have the game at their disposal. A simple movement monitor connected to a competitive video game that could motivate millions of kids to move more during the day, improving their health, well-being, and longevity. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.